Leet feigned offense. In silence, the two watched the Freeman children continue to capture sand trout. Deeper in the canyon, he knew his father rambled on about ways to increase plant growth, how to add supplementary vegetation to improve the turnover and retain nitrates in the soil. "He's probably never played with a sand trout in his life," Leet thought. He and Warwick thought of other things and stared into the night. Finally, after a long silence, both spoke at once, their words tumbling over each other. Then the two laughed and agreed. "Yes, we will both ask her when we return to Red Wall Siege." They clasped hands, hoping, but secretly relieved that they had taken the decision out of their own hands. Amid the bustle of Hynar's Siege, the Freeman greeted the return of Pardet Kynes. Young Farula pressed her hands against her narrow waist, watching the party file past the moisture-sealed doorways. Her long dark hair hung in silky loops, strung with water rings down to her shoulders. Her face was narrow and elfin-looking. Her large eyes were midnight pools below her striking eyebrows. A slight flush danced along her tanned cheeks. She regarded Leet first, then Warwick. Her face held a stern expression, with only the faintest upturn of lips to show that she was secretly pleased, rather than offended, by what the two young men had just asked her. "And why should I choose either of you?" Farula regarded both suitors for a long moment, making them squirm with the agony of anticipation. "What makes the two of you so confident?" "But..." Warwick struck his chest. "I have raided many Harkonnen troops. I have ridden a sandworm down to the South Pole. I have..." Leet interrupted him. "I've done everything Warwick has, and I am the son of Ummah Kynes, his heir and successor as planetologist. There may be a day when I leave this planet to visit the Imperial Court on Kytane. I am..." Farula impatiently dismissed their bluster. "And I am the daughter of Naib Hynar. I can have any man I choose." Leet groaned deep in his throat, his shoulders sagging. Warwick looked at his friend, but drew himself up, trying to recapture his bravado. "Well then, choose." Farula laughed, covered her mouth, and restored her tight expression. "You both have admirable qualities, a few of them at least. And I suppose if I don't make up my mind soon, you'll end up killing yourselves trying to show off for me. As if I asked for escapades like that." She tossed her head, and her long hair jingled with the bound water rings. She put a finger to her lips, pondering. Her eyes glinting with mirth, she said, "Give me 2 days to decide. I must think on this." When they refused to move, her voice became crisper. "Don't just stand there ogling me. You must have work to do. One thing I tell you, I'll never marry a lazy husband." Both Leet and Warwick nearly tripped as they scrambled to find something important-looking to occupy themselves. After waiting for 2 long, agonizing days, Leet discovered a wrapped note in his room. He tore open the spice paper, his heart pounding and sinking at the same time. If Farula had chosen him, wouldn't she come to tell him herself? But as his eyes scanned the words she had written, his breath came fast and cold in his throat. "I wait in the distant cave of birds. I will give myself to whichever man reaches me first." That was all the note said. Leet stared at it for a few moments, then ran through the siege passages until he reached Warwick's quarters. He pulled aside the curtain hanging and saw his friend frantically packing a satchel and a fremkit. "She's issued a Mina challenge," Warwick said, over his shoulder. It was a test in which Freeman youths proved themselves worthy of manhood. The two looked at each other, frozen for a moment, their gazes locking. Then Leet whirled and rushed back to his own quarters. He understood too well what he had to do. It was a race. It is possible to become intoxicated with rebellion for rebellion's sake. Dominic Vernius, Ikka's Memoirs. Even 2 years in a Harkonnen slave pit did not break the spirit of Gurney Halleck. The guards considered him a difficult prisoner, and he wore that fact like a badge of honor. Though beaten and pummeled regularly, his skin bruised, his bones cracked, his flesh slashed, Gurney always recovered. He came to know the inside of the infirmary well, to understand the miraculously fast ways the doctor could patch up injuries so the slaves could work again. Following his capture at the pleasure house, he had been thrown into the obsidian mines and polishing pits, where he had been forced to work harder than his worst days of digging trenches for kraal tubers. Still, Gurney did not miss the easier duty. At least he would die knowing he had tried to fight back. The Harkonnens did not bother to ask questions about who he was or why he had come here. They saw him as no more than another functioning body to perform tasks. The guards believed they had subdued him, and nothing else mattered to them. Initially, Gurney had been assigned to the cliffs of Mount Ebony, where he and his crewmates used sonic blasters and laser-heated handpicks to chip away slabs of blue obsidian, a translucent substance that seemed to suck light from the air. Gurney and his fellow laborers were chained together with cuffs that could extrude shiga wire to sever their limbs if they struggled. The work crew climbed up narrow mountain paths in the frosty dawn and worked through long days of battering sun. At least once a week, some slaves were killed or maimed by falling volcanic glass. The crew supervisors and guards didn't care. Periodically, they just made new sweeps around Gedi Prime to harvest additional slaves. After surviving his stint on the cliffs, Gurney was transferred to a work detail in the processing pits, where he waded in emulsifying solutions to prepare small pieces of obsidian for shipment. Wearing only thick trunks, he worked up to his waist in foul-smelling gelatinous liquid, some sort of lye and abrasive with a mild radioactive component that activated the volcanic glass. The treatment made the finished product shimmer with a midnight blue aura. To his bitter amusement, he learned that rare blue obsidian was sold only by the gem merchants of Hagal. Though assumed to be from the crystal-rich mines of Hagal itself, the source of the valuable obsidian was a carefully held secret. House Harkonnen had been quietly providing the glowing volcanic glass all along, fetching a premium price for their resources. Gurney's body became a patchwork of small cuts and slashes. His unprotected skin soaked up the foul, burning solution. No doubt it would kill him within a few years, but his chances of survival in the slave pits were slim anyway. After Beth had been taken 6 years ago, he'd given up on any sort of long-term planning. Nonetheless, as he slogged through the liquid, churning the knife-edged chunks of obsidian, he kept his face lifted toward the sky and the horizon, while the other slaves stared into the muck. Early one morning, the work supervisor stood on his podium with odor filters plugged into his nostrils. He wore a tight-fitting blue tunic that displayed his scrawny chest and the rounded paunch of his belly.
"Stop daydreaming down there! Listen up, all of you!"
He raised his voice, and Gurney heard something strange in the timbre of the words.
"A noble guest is coming to inspect our operations. Glossu Raban, the Baron's designated heir, will oversee our quotas, and likely demand more work from you lazy worms. Get ahead of yourselves today, because tomorrow you'll have a vacation while you stand at attention to be inspected."
The work supervisor scowled.
"And don't think this isn't an honor. I'm surprised Raban's even willing to put up with your stink."
Gurney narrowed his eyes. The ignominious thug Raban coming here? He began to hum a song to himself,
one of the acidly satirical tunes he had sung in the Dimitri Tavern before the initial Harkonnen attack. "Rabban, Rabban, the blustering brute, no brain in his head but rotten fruit. His muscles, his brawn, make a thinking man yawn. Without the Baron, he's destitute."
Gurney couldn't help smiling, but kept his face turned away from the work supervisor. It wouldn't do to let the man notice any amusement in a slave's expression. He couldn't wait to see the lumbering bully face to face. When Rabban and his escort arrived, they carried so many weapons Gurney had to restrain a chuckle. What was he afraid of? A bunch of work-weakened prisoners who had been battered into submission for years? The guards had activated the cores of the cuffs so that razor-edged shiga wire dug into his wrists, reminding him that a sharp jerk could slice all the way to the bone. The enhanced restraints were meant to keep the prisoners cooperative, perhaps even respectful, in front of Rabban. The ancient man bound to Gurney had such angular joints that he had an insect-like appearance. His hair had fallen out in patches, and he jittered with a neurological disorder. He had no comprehension of what was going on around him, and Gurney pitied the fellow, wondering whether this might be his own fate one day, if he lived that long. Rabban wore a black leather uniform, padded to emphasize his muscular physique and broad shoulders. A blue Harkonnen griffin adorned his left breast. His black boots were polished to a high gloss, his thick belt studded with ornamental brass. Rabban's broad face had a ruddy appearance, as if it had been sunburned too often, and he wore a black military helmet that gleamed in the hazy sunlight. Holstered at his hip was a shining flechette pistol accompanied by packs of spare needle cartridges. A nasty ink-vine whip hung at his waist. No doubt Rabban would look for any opportunity to use it. Blackish-red fluid inside the long dead stem flowed like still-living blood, causing the spiked strands to twist and curl in reflex. Its juice, a poisonous substance that had commercial properties for coloring and dyeing, could cause a great deal of pain. Rabban gave no droning speeches in front of the slaves. It wasn't his job to inspire them, merely to terrify the supervisors to squeeze out more productivity. He had already seen the slave pit operations, and now he moved up and down the line of prisoners offering no encouragement. The work manager followed, jabbering in a voice made thinner by the odor filters jammed into his nostrils. "We've done everything possible to increase efficiency, Lord Rabban. We're feeding them a bare minimum of nourishment to keep them functioning at peak performance. Their clothing is inexpensive but durable. It lasts for years, and we can reuse it when prisoners die." Rabban's stony face showed no pleasure whatsoever. "We could install machinery," the work supervisor suggested, "to do some of the menial tasks. That would improve our output." The beefy man glared. "Our objective is not merely to improve production. Destroying these men is every bit as important." He glared at them all from a position close to Gurney and the jittering, spidery old man. Rabban's close-set eyes locked on to the pathetic prisoner. In one fluid motion, he drew the flechette pistol and fired a round point-blank at the old man. The prisoner barely had time to raise his arms in a warding gesture. The spray of silvery needle projectiles chopped through his wrists and plunged through his heart, dropping him dead before he could even squawk. "Frail people are a drain on our resources." Rabban took a step away. Gurney didn't have time to think or plan, but saw in an impulsive instant what he could do to strike back. Jamming a wad of the dead prisoner's durable tunic around his own wrists to keep the wire from cutting the skin, Gurney stood up with a roar, yanking with all his might. The rag-muffled shiga wire dug and cut against his padded wrists and sliced the rest of the way through the mangled, nearly severed wrists of the dead man. Using one of the dead prisoner's detached hands like a handle, he lunged toward an astonished Rabban, gripping the shiga wire like a razor-fine garrote.
Before Gurney could slice open the burly man's jugular, Rabban moved with surprising speed. Gurney overbalanced and succeeded only in knocking the flechette pistol out of the other man's hand. The work supervisor shrieked and backed away. Rabban, seeing his pistol gone, lashed out with his ink vine whip, striking Gurney across the face on his cheek and jaw, barely missing his eye with one of the thorny strands. Gurney had never imagined a whip could hurt so much, but as the blazing cuts registered on his nerves, the ink vine juice seared like potent acid. His head exploded in a nova of pain that tunneled through his skull and into the core of his mind. He dropped the old man's still bleeding hand, letting it dangle from the sugar wire bond on one of his own wrists. Gurney toppled backward. The nearby guards rushed in. His fellow prisoners shrank away in terror, clearing a wide area. The guards closed in to kill Gurney, but Rabban held up a broad hand for them to stop. Writhing, Gurney felt only the ink-vine pain in his cheek and neck while Rabban's face burned into his vision. He might be slain soon, but for now at least he could hold on to his hatred for this Harkonnen. "Who is this man? Why is he here, and why did he attack me?" Rabban glared at the work supervisor, who cleared his throat. "I'd have to check our records, my lord." "Then check the records. Find out where he came from." Rabban fashioned a thick-lipped smile. "And see if he has any family left alive." Gurney summoned to mind the insipid words of his sarcastic song. "Rabban, Rabban, the blustering brute." But as he looked up into the broad, ugly face of the Baron's nephew, he realized that Glossu Rabban would have the last laugh after all. What is each man but a memory for those who follow? Duke Leto Atreides. One evening, Duke Leto and his concubine had been shouting at one another for more than an hour, and Thufir Hawat was troubled. He stood in the ducal wing, just down the hall from the closed door of Leto's bedroom. If either of them emerged, Hawat could slip down one of the side passageways that honeycombed the castle. No one knew the back corridors and secret ways better than the Mentat. Something crashed in the bedroom. Kylia's voice rose over the Duke's deeper, equally furious tones. Hawat didn't hear everything they said, nor did he need to. As security commander, he was responsible for the Duke's personal well-being. He didn't want to intrude, but in the present atmosphere his primary concern was the potential for violence between Leto and his concubine. The Duke shouted, exasperated. "I don't intend to spend my life arguing with you about what cannot be changed." "Then why don't you just have Victor and me killed? That would be your best solution. Or send us away to a place where you don't have to think about us, like you did to your mother." Hawat couldn't hear Leto's response, but he understood all too well why the young Duke had banished Lady Helena. "You're no longer the man I fell in love with, Leto," Kylia continued. "It's Jessica, isn't it? Has the witch seduced you yet?" "Don't be ridiculous. In the year and a half she's been with us, I've never visited her bed once, though I have every right to do so." Several moments of silence ensued. The Mentat waited in a state of tension. Kylia finally said with a sarcastic sigh, "Same old refrain. Keeping Jessica here is just politics. Refusing to marry me is just politics. Hiding your involvement with Romber and the rebels on Ix is just politics. I'm sick of your politics. You're as much a schemer as any in the Imperium." "I'm not a schemer. It's my enemies who plot against me." "The words of a true paranoid. Now I understand why you haven't married me and made Victor your rightful heir. It's a Harkonnen plot." Leto's reasonable tone slipped into open outrage. "I never promised you marriage, Kylia, but for your sake I never even took another concubine. What does it matter if I'm never to be your wife?" Choking laughter punctuated the scorn in Kylia's words. "Your faithfulness is one more show you put on to appear honorable. just politics.
Leto sucked in a sharp breath, as if the words had been a physical blow. Perhaps you're right, he agreed in a voice as icy as a Lankavile winter. Why did I bother? The bedroom door slammed open, and Hawat melted into the shadows. I am neither your pet nor a fool, Kailia. I am the Duke. Leto strode down the hallway, muttering and cursing. Behind the partially open door, Kailia began sobbing. Soon she would call Kiara, and the plump old woman would comfort her through the long night. Remaining out of sight, Hawat followed his Duke down one corridor and then another, until Leto stepped boldly into Jessica's apartment without knocking. Instantly alert from her Bene Gesserit training, Jessica summoned light from a blue glow globe. The shadowy cocoon retreated around her. Duke Leto! Sitting up in the four-poster bed that had long ago belonged to Helena Atreides, she made no attempt to cover herself. She wore a pink nightgown of slick mer-silk, cut low. A faint scent of lavender hung in the air from a pheromone emitter cleverly concealed at the ceiling joint. This night, as always, she had prepared carefully, in the hope that he would come to her. "My lord?" She saw his troubled, angry expression as he stepped into the light. "Is everything all right?" Leto's gray gaze darted around, and he breathed deeply, trying to control the adrenaline, the uncertainty, the determination that warred within him. Beads of perspiration covered his brow. His black Atreides jacket hung askew, as if he had tugged it hurriedly over his shoulders. "I am here for all the wrong reasons," he said. Jessica slid out of bed and draped a green robe over her shoulders. "Then I must accept those reasons and be grateful for them. May I get you anything? How can I help you most?" Though she had waited so many months for him, she felt little triumph, only concern at seeing him so distressed. The tall, hawk-featured man removed his jacket and sat on the edge of the bed. "I'm in no condition to present myself to a lady." Moving close to him, she massaged his shoulders. "You are the Duke, and this is your castle. You may present yourself in any manner you please." Jessica touched his dark hair and ran her fingers sensually along his temples. As if imagining a dream, he closed his eyes, then snapped them open again. She drew her finger down his cheek and placed it against his lips to silence any words. Her green eyes danced. "Your condition is perfectly acceptable to me, my lord." When she loosened the clasps on his shirt, he sighed and allowed her to nudge him toward the bed. Mentally and physically exhausted, torn by his own guilt, he lay face down on the rich coverings that smelled of rose petals and coriander. He seemed to sink into the soft, pliant sheets, and allowed himself to drift away. Her delicate hands slid across his bare skin, and she worked her fingers into the tight muscles of his back, as if she had done this for him a thousand times before. To Jessica, it felt as if this moment in eternity had always been meant to be, that Leto was destined to be here, with her. At last, he rolled over to face her. When their eyes met, Jessica saw fire there again, except it did not smolder with anger this time, nor did it fade. He took her in his arms and pressed his lips to hers in a long, passionate kiss. "I'm glad you are here, my Duke," she said, remembering all the methods of seduction the sisterhood had taught her, but with the realization that she genuinely cared about him, that she meant what she was saying. "I shouldn't have waited so long, Jessica," he said. As Kailia wept, she felt more anger at her own failure than sorrow at feeling Leto slip through her fingers.
He had disappointed her so much. Kiara had reminded her again and again of her own worth, her noble birthright, the future she deserved. Kylia despaired that these hopes were gone forever. House Vernius was not entirely dead, and its survival might very well depend on her. She was stronger than her brother, whose support of the rebels was little more than a pipe dream. Deep inside she felt a steely will. House Vernius would only survive through her efforts, and ultimately through the bloodline of her son Victor. She was determined to gain royal status for him. All of her love, all of her dreams, rested on the boy's fortunes. Finally, far into the lonely night, she fell into a fitful sleep. In ensuing weeks, Duke Leto sought Jessica more and more often, and he began to consider her his concubine. Sometimes he came into her room without a word and made love to her with feral intensity. Then, sated, he would hold her for hours and talk. Using Bene Gesserit skills, Jessica had studied him for 16 months, educating herself in the concerns of Caladan. She knew the daily difficulties Leto Atreides faced in running an entire planet, managing the affairs of a great house, attending to Lansrad matters, keeping pace with the political and diplomatic machinations in the Imperium. Jessica knew exactly what to say, precisely how to advise him without pushing. Gradually he came to see her as more than just a lover. She tried not to think of Kylia Vernius as her rival, but the other woman had been wrong to push this proud nobleman too hard, trying to bend him to her will. Duke Leto Atreides was not a man to be forced into anything. He sometimes spoke of his hardening feelings toward Kylia as he and Jessica went for long walks along the cliffside path. "You are within your rights, my lord." The young woman's tone was soft, like a summer breeze over a Caladan sea. "But she seems so sad. I wish something could be done for her. She and I might have become friends." He looked at her with a perplexed expression as the wind blew his dark hair. "You're so much better than she is, Jessica. Kylia feels only venom toward you." She had seen the Ixion woman's deep pain, the tears she tried to conceal, the dagger glares she hurled at Jessica. "Your point of view can be distorted by circumstance. Since the fall of House Vernius, she's had a difficult life." "And I made it better for her. I risked my own family fortune to keep her and Romber safe when their house went renegade. I've shown her every consideration, but she always wants more." "You once felt affection for her," Jessica said. "She bore your child." He smiled warmly. "Victor. Ah, that boy has made every moment with his mother worthwhile." For several minutes he gazed out to sea without saying anything. "You are wise beyond your years, Jessica. Maybe I will try one more time." She didn't know what had come over her, and regretted sending him back to Kylia. Mohiam would have chastised her for that. But how could she not encourage him to think kindly about the mother of his son, a woman he had loved? Despite her Bene Gesserit training, which required keeping a tight rein on one's passions, Jessica found herself becoming deeply attached, perhaps too deeply. But she had another attachment as well, one going back much longer in her lifetime. With her Bene Gesserit reproductive skills, she could have manipulated Leto's sperm and her eggs during their very first night together, thus conceiving the daughter her superiors had instructed her to produce. Why, then, hadn't she done as she'd been commanded? Why was she delaying? Jessica felt an inner turmoil over this issue, that forces within her were warring for control. Clearly the Bene Gesserit were on one side, a whispering presence insisting that she fulfill her obligations, her vows. But what opposed them? It wasn't Leto himself. No, it was something much larger and more significant than the love of two people in a vast universe. But she had no idea what it might be. The next day, Leto visited Kailia in the tower apartments where she spent most of her time, widening the gulf between them. As he entered, she turned toward him, ready to flare with anger. But he sank down beside her on a settee. "I'm sorry we see things so differently, Kailia." He took her hands firmly in his. "I cannot change my mind about marriage. But that doesn't mean I don't care for you." She pulled away, instantly suspicious. "What's the matter? Did Jessica turn you out of her bed?" "Not at all." Leto considered telling Kailia what the other woman had said to him, but reconsidered. If she thought Jessica was behind anything, she wouldn't accept it. "I have arranged to send a gift to you, Kailia." Despite herself, she brightened. It had been a long time since Leto had brought her expensive baubles. "What is it? Jewelry?" She reached for the pocket of his jacket, where he used to hide rings, brooches, bracelets, and necklaces for her. In earlier days, he had made her search his clothes for new baubles, a game that often turned into foreplay. "Not this time," Leto said with a bittersweet smile. "You are accustomed to a family home much more elegant than my austere castle. Do you remember the ballroom in the Grand Palais on Ix, with its indigo walls?" Kailia looked at him, puzzled. "Yes. Rare blue obsidian. I haven't seen anything like it in years." Her voice grew wistful and distant. "I remember as a child, being dressed in my ball gown and looking into the translucent walls. The layers within layers made reflections look like ghosts. Light from chandeliers gleamed like stars in the galaxy. I have decided to install a veneer of blue obsidian in the ballroom of Castle Caladan," Leto announced, "and also here in your chambers. Everyone will know I did it just for you." Kailia didn't know what to think. "Is this to salve your conscience?" she challenged, daring him to contradict her. "Do you think it's so easy?" He shook his head slowly. "I have gone beyond anger, Kailia, and feel only affection for you. Your blue obsidian has already been ordered from a Hagal merchant, though it will take a few months to arrive." He went to the door, paused. She remained silent, then finally drew in a long breath as if it required a great effort for her to speak. "Thank you," she said, as he left. This concludes the reading of Dune, House Harkonnen, by Brian Herbert and Kevin J. Anderson, Part 1. This book was read by Michael Pritchard. Dune, House Harkonnen, Part 2, continues the story.